Talk viewers, welcome to Watchmen Talk, your number one source for all things relating to the HBO series Watchmen. Tonight we're going to talk about martial feats of Comanche horsemanship, a painting, an episode that offered so many clues and Easter eggs and twists on the original Alan Moore story while somehow paying homage to the Zack Snyder film. And this show continues to be a work of art. So before we get started, because we have a lot of ground to cover, I just want to put out for my co-hosts that we already start the Give Watchmen a Season 2 hashtag. Because I need one. Can we agree?
I think we'll have to see what he... where it is at the end. My feeling is that this has taken a lot out of him. There's a lot here. Like, I'm afraid I'm gonna pull a muscle in my brain just trying to get through this episode.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of saying, like, I wouldn't be opposed to it yet, but it's still too early for me to say for sure we need a second one.
Okay.
Like, I would give him like 2-3 years to do it.
Yeah, like, what? I mean, we could do a Westworld kind of thing. I'd love that. We can definitely see that happening. But yeah, as it is,
Westworld was going to get a second season. That was seemed pretty wrapped, and then they had a second season, and it was great. So.
Oh, yes. So today we're talking about paintings, horsemanship, and we're going to go jump to Wendy.
Oh, yeah. So I was told by my sister that I have to go back and cover Oklahoma because my knowledge of Oklahoma is incredibly out of date, because apparently it won the Tony last year, or won Tony's last year. So,
not me, like, the award.
What, Oklahoma? What? And so it's like, this is how much I'm up on musical theater. So I apologize. Apparently, Oklahoma was redone in a modern retelling, and we'll put some links to stuff up on the blog. But in this retelling, it is very much. And it takes place kind of in a modern, so instead of picnic baskets, they raffle up crock pots, which I thought was interesting. That's electronic upgrade, but it's very stark and serious and modern. And the feeling that they put behind the songs is much more powerful than kind of the lighthearted joviality of, you know, what you saw on Watchmen and what you saw in what you would see if you went and watched the movie from the, I think it's from the 60s. So it's much different. So in Oklahoma, there was this character, the farmhand, he wasn't really totally upstanding. He had dirty pictures in his room, and he at one point, you know, contemplates suicide. And the line that was the title of last episode, running out of ice is kind of like the last line of that song. It's like, so basically in the scene where they do the song that these lyrics come from, Judd is having a hard time because, you know, he likes this girl and it's not going anywhere, and he doesn't seem to be getting respect from the town. And at the time, you know, you're just like, oh, you know, this is, you know, he's a lonely farmhand, a lonely cowboy, you know, what, you know, there's nothing really there. You don't really see it. But he's, you know, he's contemplating shooting himself because he's so depressed. And Curly comes in and they do a song about what it would be like at his funeral. And the last, you know, the last line of it is, he's looking oh so pretty and so nice. He looks like he's asleep. It's a shame that he won't keep. But it's summer and we're running out of ice. And again, the police chief's name is Judd. And the irony is he played Curly. So I think there is a layer on there I forgot to tell you the big part, that the Oklahoma, the musical, kind of framed Judd more as a modern day incel, where he spends a lot of time in his room and he's very much like, he doesn't think women like him, and everyone's out to get him, and finally he goes on the date with the girl, but she's just using him to make Curly jealous, and then he goes to attack Curly, which was more of like a, you know, like you felt like, oh, there's two men fighting for pride, you know, fighting over a girl. It was this very, you know, old school Rodgers and Hammerstein. And even in the original, Judd accidentally falls on his knife and kills himself. So there is a death. I apologize to Carolyn for kind of implying that it was very lighthearted. I guess there is a death in the beginning. I don't remember it ever affecting me when I watched it the first time, but now they have kind of reframed that play so the death has much more serious overtones, and his attack on Curly has, you know, for dating the girl that he likes, it has much more serious overtones than it did. And the trial was probably a lot more serious too. I'm not lucky enough to have tickets. If anybody wants to send me tickets, I will definitely go. But I have not seen the play, so I'm assuming that it's taken, that the court case has taken a bit more seriously and not quite as, happy ending as it was originally. But if we remember Don Johnson, his character is named Judd, and he played Curly in high school. So we all know now that he has some secrets. So is Judd, you know, poor Judd is dead, as the song goes, we're sitting here, you know, wondering if he's played himself as Curly, but really in reality he's been Judd all along. So that will be an interesting topic to talk about, but I thought it was interesting. I think if you want to learn more about this stark and gritty modern retelling of Oklahoma, we'll post some links up on the blog.
Awesome. So you guys want to just break it down and we'll start jumping on that, because I think that talking about Judd, given how the episode starts, would be a perfect way to launch into things. If you've been following Watchmen, you've noticed that there's the PDpedia, which has been releasing various documents that have been enhancing the world of Watchmen, which makes me think that they're prepping for a potential season two, because there's no way that they would invest time and effort into one fully cognitive experience. However, my portion of today's show will be talking about creating cognitive experiences in regards to acting and actors. So who knows, perhaps that is something like that, but we're going to start with breaking it down and then we're going to go into that kind of stuff. Everybody cool?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I have so many little nuggets, but we'll get started. I don't know if anybody noticed the very first lines of the episode this week. We had the officer comes in and asks for Fräulein Mueller.
Yeah.
Which this is the first Mueller to be mentioned in this episode. But if you include the supplemental materials, we have three.
Mm-hmm. So Mueller's directly connected to everybody in regards to this.
Yeah, so there's something going on here, and we're going to get more into this.
So, but Mueller is tasked by a Nazi commandant to create a flyer to try and turn the Black Americans against other Americans while they are fighting in World War II.
World War One. Yeah, World War One.
My bad, World War One.
Yeah, no, I thought that this was interesting in the way that parallels how essentially white people will use Black people's pain and suffering and trauma and weaponize it against other white people. And like, it's always just this, like, this ball, like, it gets tossed back and forth, like, we're better because, you know, here's all this. They're speaking all of the truth and saying all these things that are actually, like, real. Like, that's real shit. Yeah. But it's also like, your life isn't going to be better in Berlin. It's just, they're taking a certain truth and warping it in a really shitty way, but it's so accurate because that people still do this to this day. I see it all the time on my timeline, man. It's in every election. It's ridiculous. But it's fascinating how it's the way it just was shot. Like the way the papers were flying out of the plane and the guy, his dad getting spit on. Like, it was just like, yeah, it was, yeah.
There's something interesting. It's kind of hard not to talk about Nazis in the media, but I can recall several sources that I've read, and admittedly I didn't have a direct source, but it would make sense to me, truthfully, that a lot of the systems that Nazi Germany adopted in regards to the oppression of Jewish people, they learned from the United States.
Yeah, I've heard that as well. Specifically in regards to like Germany and like their structure of setting up the laws that set up for the Nazi takeover, I guess, is I do think it is specifically like the Jim Crow era legislation that is said to inspire versus like the entire like background of slavery and everything. So
I would say that, yeah, I mean, I would say the reality is that almost doesn't matter what country it is, almost all slavery is race-based. It's always any race of a darker skin tone has always been subjugated by a race of a lighter skin tone. That's just history. Like, that's throughout history. So going back to the show, we were talking about like the actual like propaganda from, you know, Germany starting. I actually took a World War I class in college, like reading the actual history of how this whole thing got started. And everyone was like, oh, you know, World War II is a more interesting war. But World War I was fascinating to me because it just was a series of unfortunate events that just collapsed in on itself, causing Germany to just progress into this, house of cards that collapsed eventually later on. And I think that they've always taken the advantage of, in that era, taken advantage of people, you know, who are oppressed naturally, taking advantage of their oppression and what they've gone through, and lobbed it against someone else as a weapon. I think you see that here and see that throughout history. And I think that's continuing. I think you can see parallels literally from the beginning of the episode to the end of the episode. I'll talk about that later. But yeah.
You know, what's great about Watchmen, I think, that we all need to acknowledge is that HBO is really starting off every episode with something that people need to talk about and discuss and face. We move forward with Reeves, who seems to listen to this, doesn't seem to listen to this. What do we think about that?
He continues on, but he puts it in his pocket and he never throws it out. And not only does he never throw it out, but he goes back for it during the riot to make sure he gives it to his son. And if we're going back to the Superman allegory, those are the Kryptonian crystals that Jor-El puts into baby Kal-El's basket.
I'm going to interrupt and say the dad's name is actually Obi Williams, mm-hmm. not Reeves.
Oh.
Obi Williams. And they own the theater. That's what I noticed this episode in particular about that Williams name. So I don't know specifically why the child has a different last name or anything like that, but...
Well, I assume he's adopted, right, after this?
I don't know. Maybe. I mean, it would parallel a modern adoption of the three kids.
And then we go back to Angela, and we go back to Hooded Justice. Can we all agree, though, that he is Hooded Justice? I mean, because I've noticed that is a, you know what I mean? That's I just need to agree that he's Hooded Justice. I just need
Yeah, the colors, his like little hoodie, like everything kind of like lines up to him being, that's his character or his, you know.
And Hollis Mason in the Under the Hood, I think, and definitely, so in Under the Hood and then definitely in the Before Watchmen, Minutemen book, which I know we're not counting Before Watchmen as anything. There is a lot of suspicion as to, I think in the Before Watchmen, they come right out and say that Mueller was not Hooded Justice, that they were different people. But that's, well, we'll talk more about that when we get to the American Hero story.
Yes, indeed, you do. So, but Hooded Justice and she have a conversation, and she arrests him and then takes him back to the area, and they have an argument about...
It was more abduction than arrest.
Yeah, I was going to say, she didn't really arrest him.
So more of an abduction than an arrest, and they have an argument. They go back to the area, and she lets it out, and there's... I love Regina King.
She's so good.
I've been converted. I need to actually watch The Leftovers now.
Yes, finally. Oh my God. Because you keep talking about watching season two, possibly, like, I was like, listen, if you watch The Leftovers, you will understand that if they end up doing, like, Watchmen in The Leftovers format, where there's, like, it moves to, like, every season was in locations, I could totally see Watchmen kind of following the same format, where it's just in different locations and different kind of, like, shifting through. Anyway, so everyone watch Leftovers. It's great. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, so we should watch. What you're saying is we need to support all of these shows, HBO, hint, hint, because we support of all of these shows, HBO, hint, hint. But yeah, no, this has definitely converted me into watching Leftovers, because the scene where Angela is just raging against the machine was really, really emotional, and you never see women get to do that, and I was. I really picked up on that, because that's very much a masculine moment where the guy's like, you know, rage against the machine. But she did it, and she came back and she reacted completely differently, because that would also be the moment where a traditionally masculine character would have just beat the shit out of the dude, and she didn't. And that was very refreshing, because she learned, she kind of introduced the idea, I think, that we can, Vanessa's theory, and that Mr. Reeves, Hood of Justice, was an enhanced human, made proof correct, because he just,
yep.
Which is kind of awesome. So she interviews him, and then she gets called back out to the tree where Judd is hanging from the tree.
I guess before we get to that, I do want to mention, like, specifically about how she suits up. I feel like that's almost like a defense mechanism for her, like it gave her some kind of bravado in a way where she was able to fake it, or like it's kind of a maybe the not necessarily my real face thing, but kind of like that. Like,
no, it is. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
There's a line later in the episode that I wrote down from American Hero Story that totally fits. Okay, so I've never felt comfortable in my own skin, or I looked at myself in the mirror and I always saw someone different. I never felt comfortable in my own skin, so I made a new one, and when I slipped it on, he and I became one. Who am I? If I knew the answer to that, I wouldn't be wearing a fucking mask.
Mm-hmm.
And I was, so they really delve into the themes of that later in the episode, and I want to talk about it, because I want to talk about it in relation to acting and the psychological effect, and the reason that acting is very important in the Watchmen universe, because it's not the only time that it's been mentioned. But I totally agree with that assessment, that like she is protecting herself so that she's able to go. Did anybody else notice that the press called her detective? Do you think that was because of the car, or do you think that
the detectives, all of the detectives, I believe, are the ones that can. So the cops are the ones in the yellow with this. The actual police officers are the ones. The patrolmen are like the yellow mask in the regular patrol suit. The detectives are all the ones in the actual. They're not vigilantes. They're actual detectives, all of them. So the ones that are all dressed up and like get to have fancy like names and suits, those are all detectives. They're like detective level. Yeah. So there was a quick moment. I don't know if you guys noticed that on the wall, on the brick wall, there was like a shadow, like graffiti of two people. Like, yes. A shadow of two people kissing on the wall. I was like, ah, yes, that reference. Oh my God. And that was before her going to the murder site. And I was like, that's that was such a clear, like, Rorschach, like, reference. It was so, I caught that. It was, I don't know if I
didn't watch
it.
So it's the Hiroshima Lovers, which was art that represented the imprint of two people in Hiroshima. Mm-hmm. When the bomb goes off, it leaves a negative image on the wall behind them.
Yes.
But it's painted a whole bunch of different times, and we talked about this when we were covering Watchmen. It's painted like that, and a whole bunch of different times throughout the graphic novel, and everybody who sees it slightly differently. Like, of course, Rorschach sees it as something dirty, you know, but other people see it as something beautiful. So it's, and again, of course, it's kind of paralleled by everybody right before the attack of the giant squid at the end of the book.
And it's referenced throughout the episode too, because like with her, you know, holding when they were taking him down later on, and then her husband holding her on Christmas night. Like, you could, the symbolism kept like kind of like repeating itself throughout the episode of like a man and woman holding on to each other or whatever. So I thought that was really cool.
Yeah, I didn't notice that.
I caught the one at the end, but I didn't catch the dance scene as also part of that.
I look at everything from like, from how, when I like gift something, I'm like, ooh, I caught her holding on to something, and I was just like, so it's just like I'm really in protective mode about her husband now because I really don't want him to die.
I got a theory that might not be nice. But...
I'm sorry.
He's perfect. I know he's gonna die.
He didn't get hurt. Remember? I know.
Yeah, I have like suspicions. I'm like, really? He like, where was he? Okay, yeah, we'll talk about that, because I was like, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There were three people, according to one of the PPs. Yes. There's mm-hmm. three people that survived.
Mm-hmm.
So that is interesting. So whoever saved hers, or maybe she, I mean, the whole story was that she stabbed the guy and he just didn't, was too weak to shoot her, which I don't believe at all.
Which was not her memory. Anyway, yeah. Well, yeah. Okay.
And we haven't gotten to the point yet. But when we get there, I feel really personally hurt that we didn't find out what was in the box yet.
Yeah, the box. Oh, my God. Anyway, so not to belittle that point, because it's the episode seems to cover relationships. And we really do learn, going back to the hanging because of Hood of Justice. We really learn, I think, a little bit more about Angela and Looking Glass's relationship, because Looking Glass is stone cold.
He's ice cold.
Is he, though? So that's the question. So let's point out something very, very... So first of all, he was extremely Rorschach. I think we can agree he's extremely
like
Rorschach.
Eating in
yeah, he was just a mask. But remember, when he was talking to Judd, his mask was completely off, and Judd had to remind him to put his face back on. And now that Judd is dead... He will, even when he's at home with his TV dinner, he only reveals his mouth.
Ooh. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the scene where in the car where he was sitting with, he was asking her if she had any snacks, and he like pulled the nuts out and like was eating. It reminded me of the scene where Dan found Rorschach in his kitchen eating the beans. Like, it was just like, he doesn't. Yeah, he like doesn't pull his face. I don't know how many times we're going to see his face from now on, actually, now that you pointed that out.
Yeah.
That's really sad. But it's also, it goes down to, once we get to my section, I have all about acting, man. All about acting and the core of why human beings tell stories, because that shit is my jam. Anyway, so we learn a little bit more about him, and we learn a little bit more about Angela. And now my notes are fading. What happens after?
So they go to take him down, and Angela hugs him.
Mm-hmm.
And we get the flashback, which reminded me, of course, of the funeral, even though the funeral is next week.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, the funeral of the comedian. But she has her flashback to the time that they met, which was way more recent than I think any of us expected.
Yeah, I think there was
about that, but I mean, I remember it, but I don't have anything to say about it. Sorry.
Well, it's so the whole thing was that it starts with the White Knight, mm-hmm. and she's dancing with the husband, and he wants to open the present, and she's like saying, nope, you're gonna wait, which
it's like all that clock symbolism, of course.
Yeah, and then the clock was gonna tick, 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 and it was getting to midnight. And you see the clock again, and we'll talk about that later, but that's, I think that clock is going to become very important. So the clock isn't the present, because the clock's already on the wall. And I knew that somehow that clock, and it was going to have something to do with,
something happening.
Well, A, her, that was part of the reason why she was saved. Right. So she figures out very quickly that someone's in the house, mm-hmm. and she's able to get, you know, improvised weapons and then steal a weapon. And now you see why she has a shotgun in her headboard,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, the middle of the night was when this attack happened. And she isn't completely successful. She does get shot, which was shocking mm-hmm. to me, but,
who shot her?
Yeah. So here's So here's my thing. Okay. Another enhanced theory, since I'm the one who keeps like pulling out, I'm like noticing these little things. She has these, I don't know, like her senses, she can sense things, like she can hear things because, or she can just sense things because I noticed this at the, when the, basically the police stormed into Nixonville later on, there was another instance where she just noticed something where she shouldn't really have, there's no way she could have noticed it, but if she's the granddaughter of someone who else is enhanced, it makes sense. It's genetic. So I'm just saying, I think homegirl might be a little enhanced, then she may not realize it. So that's just back up on just,
I forgot something about grandpa. I forgot something. When she makes the cup of coffee.
Yes. I put that on my notes. Yeah. And he just drank that.
Yeah. She just gives him this piping hot coffee, black coffee, and he drinks it down. I think he knows why she gave him the cup.
I literally have enhanced in all caps with 3 exclamation points after that note. Like, I fully, like, this is my theory. Like, I think the whole family's enhanced. Like, something. Anyway. But yeah, I think something was weird. Something doesn't add up when he says that she stabbed him and overcame him. And I was like, but then how did she stab? She remembers stabbing dude and then getting shot. So how did she stab her shoot? Like the two things didn't line up. So someone's lying. Someone's lying to her, or she doesn't remember something. And where was her husband?
Exactly. Yeah. If your guys' theory about the Superman allegories is correct, because I'm showing my Marvel ignorance here, you guys keep mentioning the Superman allegory, wouldn't it make sense that with Hood of Justice and all of them being like these super characters, then you know, that it would be a whole super family. So it would be like the Supermen of the Watchmen universe, like the dawning of, not the Supermen because that's Dr. Manhattan, but even then. And I wouldn't rule out the possibility that Dr. Manhattan just going to throw this out there, fully preparing to be wrong. I wouldn't throw out the possibility that Dr. Manhattan, because they kept mentioning him in the scene where they were talking. I would not throw out the possibility that Dr. Manhattan is going back and fucking with people's DNA.
You think he's time traveling?
I wouldn't be surprised. There's something going on. It was honestly almost creepy. To the point where they kept repeating, it felt like they were being fed a line. Like, he's on Manhattan, or he's on Mars. And I was like, why? It just felt like a line that kept, like, something was really
makes himself feel comfortable that he's on Mars.
Weird. Something about it was weird to me.
Later in the episode with Topher, with the boy whose parents, so we're tying this back into the timeline so that we can go through the boy whose parents died during the White Knight because Angela and her husband adopted the three kids who are
her partner.
So they adopted the children. Topher is building the castle that Manhattan built.
Yes. The set is called something like Magna Hatton blocks, and it's the box that they come in are blue, and it floats. It's magnets. It's on a magnetic pad, so he does not have power. That's not a power thing. But castle, which is the castle that the English country gentleman is living in, and is the castle that was built by Manhattan on Mars. There's something going on here, and we know that Veidt, the first time around, made things that influenced public consciousness to prepare them for what he was about to do. We haven't got to Veidt yet, and how I don't know if he's the mastermind this time, but we'll see.
I'm gonna throw it out there. I think that like the footage and all of the like of him on Mars and like all that, I think it's just literally another hoax. I think that they have no idea where Dr. Manhattan is, and that is terrifying to the public, and they have to assure the public that the most powerful being in the universe is with, you know, within their sight. So I feel like this is just yet another government hoax. I'm on that conspiracy train. Market
that. I could see that, or I could see it being a very old image, as I feel like maybe, I don't know, it definitely feels like one of those things where like that they're kind of chanting it to make themselves feel better, but if he has not come back now, why would he come back?
Right. I don't think later. He's bad. Yeah.
Yeah. Unless, you know, maybe Lori asks him to, but we'll get there.
I, I'm gonna stick with my theory, and I'm fully prepared to be wrong. I'm just gonna say it. I really do think Manhattan is going back in time and like influencing, because Manhattan at this point, the powers that he has, he could do whatever the heck he wants. He could come to our reality and be like, "Hi, boom, Damon Lindelof, you're canceling the show, boo." But he could come to our reality. So I think he's going back and messing with people. That's my whole.
There's not a lot that has still, even prior to Dr. Manhattan's existence, there is not a lot that has materially changed. There is the name of the picture, which is backwards. So it's one of those things where it's not that off, but it could be. So the painting is actually called Comanche Feats of Martial Horsemanship and not Martial Feats of Comanche Horsemanship. So I don't know if maybe that's just like they had a different translation or whatever. I don't think it isn't another language, but we'll get to that in a bit. But it is backwards. So that was one of the things, like, why did they change that? So I'm not saying there's any credence to this theory that there's a lot of, you know, messing around in the past, because the past doesn't seem to have changed that much. And again, we need to realize the things that we thought were fake were real, and we actually did them.
So we're back to,
we are 40 back houses, to... all sleep, white knight, three survivors.
Yeah.
I'm going to drop my theory now. Sorry. Okay, I think Judd's is following someone's instructions to set up the vigilantes and all that. And, I'm going to back up a little bit. When I realized they gave all the cops guns, access to their guns, I remembered Sinestro Corps War, where the Green Lanterns got lethal force enabled. And that was all because Sinestro only did Sinestro Corps War because he wanted the Green Lanterns to be able to kill, because he knew Blackest Night was coming. So I'm wondering if Judd knew something was about to happen, and he's involved in setting up White Knight and all that. But I also think Calvin is involved somehow.
Do you want to know? Sorry. Do you want to go one further? So the Keen, who is the new candidate for president, is actually related to the other Keen. And the bill that allowed the cops to wear masks
was another
an addendum onto
the bill. The Keen Act, Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely some, and again, some of this stuff is from PDPedia, so I apologize for jumping ahead, but there is still that. So, was the original Keen Act laid in place so that this could be laid onto it later? So there is still a part of me that's hoping that this is still part of Adrian's, you know, part two of his plan, and that things have been going all along. But it is interesting that is an addendum to the original Keen Act.
So we have Redfordations, that is essentially kind of like used as a slur which are reparations for descendants of, you know, Racist Violence Act, which is a part of, what is it called, the Racial Violence Act?
Victims of Racial Violence Act.
Yes. Yeah,
and it's specifically in this case, another PDPedia, related to the
Tulsa Massacre. Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. And so she takes the mug, which was so clever of her. I don't know if it was clever of her, he just did it on purpose, but I just love that, like, she, like, obviously was doing, like, gave him the cup of coffee to take his DNA, which if anyone watches Barry, I had literally just watched an episode, I'm catching up on Barry, and just watched an episode where Fugues is like, "Oh, you can't take my DNA," and he drank like a Coke, and then he sat it down. And he's like, "You'll never get my DNA," and they were like, "Okay, dumbass," and he took his Coke anyway.
Yeah.
And took his DNA. It was the same exact thing. So I was just like loving it. Just cops doing cop shit. But I thought that was I thought that, like, that whole scene was so cool. I loved, like, cool tech about, like, they're like, the fact that they don't have like internet, and like they're just like, but they still have cool shit that we don't have, is fascinating, that the continued world building. And then Louis Gossett Jr. is like a senator, or no, a secretary, sorry, was he
U.S. secretary? Treasury yes. Secretary, yeah,
yes, which is just dope. Like, everything was just like really cool the way they the whole thing was built up.
Yeah, and the fact that, but the thing is, the thing that we have to note here is, A, you know, this exists, so isn't it convenient that there's a place that you can just go in and test your DNA?
Right, the government, also... yeah, the government is just, like, taking your, which is the same thing with people sending in their, like, what is it, Ancestry.com and all that stuff, like,
yeah,
it's the exact same thing.
But she, so she's able to test the DNA on this cup without needing to go to the lab or let anyone in, so mm-hmm. she is still hiding all of this. Mm-hmm. from work, which is intriguing, and I think part of this is because she kind of doesn't want anybody looking at anyone other than who she wants it to be at this point, which of course changes by the end of the episode, but at this mm-hmm. point she's still thinking he's crazy, it's totally the cavalry.
So it, but and then we move into everybody is getting angry at the cavalry and at the residents of Nicktonville.
Mm-hmm.
And so in a real, in a twist, and it was definitely a very interesting scene. Red Scare wants to go and wants to bust some heads, and the police are allowed to do that. So they go and they break up Nicktonville.
And Mount Up Cowboys.
This is a police tactic, right? So like, if you all come and you know, we'll be fine. And of course, somebody throws a rock, and then all heck breaks loose.
Yep.
Yeah, police move into neighborhoods all the time. You know, they do this all the time. It's not, this is nothing new.
Yeah.
But it is interesting, her reaction to it all, because she wasn't sure. She was unsure about it from the beginning. As soon as she saw that old man underneath Uncle Judd's dead body, I think she was unsure from the beginning. Was it Calvary? She has no idea. So I think it was just her amongst the chaos, her reaction and looking at her whole, the conversation, they were having a full on conversation, when just full on police brutality. And then there was another direct parallel where she's watching Red Scare bust into someone's trailer and kicking them out, what she just did the previous episode. So it's just so fascinating watching her. Just them adding new layers and depths to her character from a completely different shade of what we saw in the first episode.
And again, the twist here is that this is what Rorschach did after the comedian, right? He went to the bar and busted heads until someone gave him a lead.
Can I just say, as annoyed as we might all be with Red Scare, the line where he goes, "I'm not a Nazi."
Oh, I'm not annoyed with him.
Okay.
I find him fascinating. I find him hilarious. We all need a laugh, and I think he's hilarious. I don't know.
You go Sister Night Red Scare for me in terms of favorite character so far.
Oh yeah, the line where you're right. Yeah, the line where he said, he's not a Nazi, he's a communist or whatever. I was like, which is hilarious because that was like that was the original scare from. Literally, in the 80s, like the Red Scare. It was so great mm-hmm. that they added that in a physical format with the dude in an accent. And I would be so, I would die if in like a later episode they reveal it's not even his real accent. Like he's just an American with a fake Russian accent. Like it's all a fucking persona. Like I would bet money on it. Like,
yeah. It's what scared him as a kid. So now it's what he is as an adult.
Mm-hmm.
But yep. It is interesting. All of these names. So now you're questioning everybody. So
absolutely.
So Judd was the cowboy in the white hat who used to be the mm-hmm. good guy. We'll talk about this when we get to the painting again. But but you know he used to be the good guy. You know, right? So now I'm looking at Pirate Jenny, and I'm like, Pirate Jenny was the captain of the Black Freighter in the song that we talked about a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. So she's choosing the name Pirate Jenny. She may have something to hide here that isn't very cop-like about getting revenge on people who wronged her and being patient about waiting for her revenge. So that's something we'll have to remain to be seen. She could just be there to look cool.
I just like love her whole look, and I'm a fan of Jessica Camacho from Flash anyway, so I'm just like excited. Even if, I just hope that her role is beyond just standing there looking hot, but if it's just that, I'm okay with it. So
well, she does get to talk next week, so
yes, I'm so excited with Lauren. Okay guys, anyway,
all right, so he threatens to bring Oh, yeah, but he threatens to pull down their statue, which I think is kind of a callback to Berlin and the divisions of Berlin and pulling down the statue of Stalin and when the Berlin Wall fell. And, you know, again, it was a city divided, and this is very much a city divided.
And it's interesting because I remember seeing these scenes in the trailer and thinking like, oh, this is interesting, cool action scene. And then actually seeing it within the context of the episode, I was like, this is terrifying. What the fuck? Like, it was so disturbing to watch.
Yeah, I think that was, I think that's the point, kind of. No, like, yeah, right. It is like their culture of brutality and all that they got going on. It's not great.
No, yeah, brutality is an issue. Yeah,
and the violence therapy. I wrote that one down because
when we get to the newsstand, I have some interesting things to talk about. But we'll get there. So where are we now?
We're rounding them up. She's beating the hell out of someone. She just really—I don't know how that dude's alive. But she just fucking wailed on him. And then after that, where are we at?
Well, I noticed in that whole scene that they did show the current in real life U.S. flag, but it was like the 50 state one.
The
Vietnam is a state flag. Oh, I think we might have skipped over the newsstand.
Oh, wait, let's go back.
So should we go back and talk to the newsstand? So the newsstand, obviously, so on the obvious thing, there's New Frontiersman is how it starts off. And it's talking about how the squid rain is it might be a hoax, and then of course the guy in the newsstand is talking about it, and this throws back to the newsstand in the comics. And instead of a little boy, there's a little girl, and we could talk about, if you guys want to talk about the individual things that the guy in the newsstand said, but I thought it was interesting that the little girl is picking up papers for somebody else. They're liberal papers, and Nova Express is one of them. Nova Express was the liberal version of New Frontiersmen, but Nova Express is actually a William S. Burroughs book. He's the guy that did Naked Lunch, but it was an interesting book, and I'll tell you why. So Nova Express was from the original Watchmen, was the title of that paper in the original Watchmen, so that is there. So this may not be in it, but I have to have a feeling that if they're going this deep on everything else, they understand why Nova Express was chosen, and they're calling it out here on purpose, because Nova Express was about cops and criminals, and it was done in a very expensive, this might be the segue into what Carolyn wants to talk about. It was done in a very experimental way called a cut-up method, where it's just kind of little vignettes from different perspectives and different people's mind, and it's kind of very confusing as to whose mind you're in and what they're talking about. And it kind of treats criminals and the police as kind of pieces of the body, like disease and white blood cells, and how the police need the criminals because without them they wouldn't exist, and the criminals need the police. So it's just like this kind of very symbiotic relationship.
Oh yeah. So what it's going back to is it's going back to the that conversation from The Dark Knight where Joker's talking to Batman, and Joker's like, you know, you need me. We're two of the same people. You can't exist without me. And Batman's like, I'm nothing like you. And he goes, no, we're the same. But that's essentially, I think, to build a successful society, you have to, there will always be similarities and parallels between everybody will be capable of everything else. And this is a very nihilist perspective for me to take, and I do apologize for that. I just think that, you know, the deeper that you look, the deeper you're going to see that, you know, there's a lot of similarities. And it was really, and I'll give you an example. With the newsstand, you know, you have these two guys who are running the newsstand, and they both happen to be black, and they both are taking the fake news standpoint. And that was very weird to me, because the only person who I've seen who was really believed in that was, you know, Kanye. We're not going to get into that, because that's a lot.
You would have to broaden your scope then, because that's a common... I don't think that's uncommon amongst older black men, not at all. at
And you
all.
see, and there's a bunch, there's like these dudes who like have like weird like sexist ideals, or they say women have their
Hotep.
periods because, yeah, those guys. And it there's a lot of there's
It's
in
a
every
very, it's
sector.
very varied. Kanye is not surprising to anyone, any black woman or any black person that has it. He was always, that was always something that was a long time coming. Older black men, even like, he's not gonna listen to this, so I can call him out. My dad, he's one of those people who, he was just talking, I just saw him last week. We were talking about, he's talking about a conspiracy theory about, and I don't know if anyone else listening to this podcast subscribes to this, but a conspiracy theory about the Chinese mafia murdering Bruce Lee because he was bringing kung fu to America. That this is a thing. It's not surprising to me at all that these guys that went sitting at the newsstand talking, like these are dudes. They could have easily been sitting in a barbershop. That's familiar to me as old dudes, old black dudes talking, and it was just very relevant. And then I was geeking out because I saw that they had Source and Vibe magazine. I'm like, they absolutely have to have black people on the in the background working in the back and on the show, because the level of detail in the fact that because there is no internet, that magazines like that would still be in print is fucking amazing. Like, I cannot even, I didn't even think like that. I can't. The level of detail is so good on this show. I'm sorry, I'm just geeked. Like, it was so good.
I fucking love it. I mean, yeah, okay. No, I learned a thing today, guys. I really did, 'cause so the use of Libstoppo, then that was definitely a term I saw Vanessa tweet out, and then I watched like, you know, it, we are one. It's a shame that the alt-right refuses to watch this show because apparently it's too political, and that's very interesting. But so it's a shame that they refuse to watch it, because I could just see that being a term that catches on. So perhaps it's a good thing they didn't watch it. Because that is definitely something so but we have the so there's all these different things, and I learned. Cool. Okay. Yeah, no, this feels good. This is what the shows are doing though. It's like it's broadening people's horizons. So now that we've talked about the newsstand, we are jumping back to where were we? We finished breaking down Nixonville.
We got the recordations at the museum, and then did she go to
Yeah, I think that's where we are now, where she went back home.
she went back home, and then wait, who was okay? Can you guys please clarify to me who was I'm assuming the grandpa of the kids, correct, on the porch?
Yes.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay,
He like the uncle?
yeah, I
I
thought
thought,
I assumed uncle.
oh,
I didn't know
drunk
how old he
uncle?
was.
Okay.
Whatever he is, he's the relative
He's
that
a surviving,
probably
yeah,
could have
he's the one
ever.
who should have the right, but. Some he you know he's him.
Yeah,
So
I was gonna say he probably. I wonder why he didn't get. Yeah.
so we walk in and Cal, Mr. Perfect, is playing with the kids inside, hiding from their uncle or grandfather or whatever. The kids are dressed up, interestingly enough, as a pirate, which of course we know comics are all pirates, and an owl, maybe some kind of reference to Night owl, I don't know. There are a lot of owls. I think that's just a thing, maybe. And then Cal is there playing the ghost, but the irony here is he is dressed in a white sheet.
Just like he was wearing the white mask during the white night. Sorry. That's my new conspiracy theory.
That's your
He's the cavalry? Ooh,
I don't
that
know
would
if
hurt.
he's I'm not sure the cavalry fully did it. I'm sure they claimed it, but it was
There's a
engineered
deep
by
and insidious
yeah.
conspiracy.
Oh,
think
my brain.
So yeah.
Why would they? Interesting. Okay.
So I thought it was very ironic. I think it could just be there to kind of, put that in your head to remind you to be scared when you see the Klan. I shouldn't have to be reminded, but there is a kind of connection there. This is the bad guy in the white sheet.
Why did she mention it was very interesting too that and I don't know if it adds to Angela's character or what, but she mentioned because they were like, we're gonna kill the ghost, and she was like, okay, we'll make sure to put rocks in his pocket
The second.
to weigh him down. And I was like, that is a
It
rather
sounds
dark.
sick, but if your kids are playing superheroes, now flip it on its head. Your kids are
Okay.
playing superheroes, right? And they're, let's say they're fighting Mr. Mixapilic. You're going to tell them, you got to get them to say his name backwards. Or if they're, you know, it's.
That's decidedly lighter than weighing a body down.
He's a ghost.
Wendy has a solid point. I mean, I work with kids on a daily basis, and sometimes kids are very literal. And sometimes you get kids who will be like, you know, I'll go up to them and I'll be like, oh, what are you going to be for Halloween? And they'll go, Harley Quinn. And I go, oh, from DC Supergirls. That's a great show. She goes, no, I'm going to be Harley Quinn from Suicide Squad. And I'm like,
it's a little dark.
And I'm like, you're 6 years old and you're going to be. And it's the same. And it's the same with the other shows that kids watch, like Five Nights at Freddy's. And we're not going to go into a long tangent on this, but Five Nights at Freddy's is a story about robots that are filled with the souls of dead children that were murdered by a child killer.
And kids, the kids show. I wouldn't. But they have.
No, but that's legit. That's legit. A kid. That's a kid game. A kid program. And the kids are like, "Oh, I love these toys." And I'm like, "That's a representation of a dead child." But okay, sure, you love them.
Yokai too is like that. Yokai is dead pets. That was like,
is it a representation of the child, or is it the actual child? What is the essence of a being, I guess?
Oh, of the Five Nights at Freddy's. So what happened? I can tie this back into the show too, because I'm master of the math. So what happened in Five Nights at Freddy's was that there was this guy named the Purple Man, and the Purple Man was William Afton, who built these audio animatronics. And according to the lore, he would take these kids and he would put them in, and he would kidnap them and he would kill them and he would put them inside these Chuck E. Cheese like audio animatronics. And the kids' souls, the kids' bodies rotted. And so they closed down the pizzeria because everybody was like, didn't want to go there because it smelled really bad. But then the kids take over the robots. And so the robots kill any adult that enters the pizzeria at night. And you can look at that in relation to this, because you get these kids that have such a weird relationship with death and with trying to talk to different, you know, with death. So when, because they're very literal, children are very, very literal. I don't even have kids, and I know that kids are very, very literal. So when, Angela takes that with Topher, which takes us back to the Topher building scene. So that's how I related Five Nights at Freddy's to Watchmen. You're welcome.
That is incredibly disturbing, and we will never, ever, 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 ever put that on the house again. I think they've only ever seen it mentioned like on Minecraft videos.
don't ever expose your kids to that, or Bendy and the Ink Machine, because these are kids games. Bendy and the Ink Machine is about an evil studio that turns all of its employees into ink demons. But children are very literal, and so you have all these different characters, and you and that's why when Angela goes and talks to Topher is very literal, and she's like, the world is in black and white. What do you think she meant?
I think this is Rorschach. I think this is where, and Mr. A, and like I posted it on Twitter. I posted the Mr. A speech from the Emperor's of Ice Cream song on Twitter. There's wrong and there's right. There's black and there's white, and there's nothing, nothing in between. This is Rorschach's philosophy. The mask, the white and the black don't meet. And you're hearing that echo in her. So I'm not saying that like she's literal one-to-one relationship to Rorschach. I'm saying that Rorschach's journey had an effect on a lot of people, and she may be even being manipulated to being more Rorschach by the insidious conspiracy, but it is definitely, without a doubt, supposed to make you think of Rorschach's black and white speeches.
Because media affects people, which is going to tie into my acting stuff later in the episode. So she talks to the kid, and she tells them that Uncle Jed is dead, and Topher asks her not to tell the other kids, because he wants to do it. And then he knocks over the castle, because they keep showing that the castle is going to get knocked over, and I'm pretty sure that whatever is going to happen to the old English man's house is not going to be good. I think it's going to blow up. So anyway, she's told them this. Then what happens?
And then we get to the funeral, right? Or like the wake.
The Wake,
no,
yes.
American Hero Stories.
Oh, yeah, American Hero Story. That was the, it's like amazing how they paralleled that with like how the, it, I hope this is how they do it. I'm assuming, I think I read something where they are weaving this in, where it's going to be a show within a show, where mm-hmm. it's essentially going to be like the tale of the Black Freighter, how yep. it was woven in with the original. So I think that's beautiful how it was, he was like talking about, Carolyn already quoted it, where he's talking about like his face and like all this stuff, and it's overlaid with her just driving in the rain. It was just like beautiful.
And remember, the pirate story was tonal and didn't have a direct, except for revealing things about characters, didn't have a direct correlation, but this might have a direct correlation. We will see. But the beginning, to me, and we can go deep into the actual, you know, what we know about Hooded Justice, but the beginning to me was very reminiscent to Sunset Boulevard. It's a classic scene, the body floating, doing the narration in the water. You know, this is me, this is how I, you know, you've heard this story, but I'm going to tell you the real story. That comes from the first time that appeared was in Sunset Boulevard. Which was a movie about a writer, and it, you know, again, it was telling the murder mystery and secrets unraveled from what you expected it to be in the beginning, and turned out to be something completely different. Although they're kind of spoiling that that's what's happening here, right?
Mm-hmm. And I love the callback, the call to like Ryan Murphy and the excessive Zack Snyder violence, and like yeah. just the sepia tone, the everything. It was just so. So on point for a modern retelling, modern gritty telling of these like heroes. I loved it.
And you're not sure at the end if they're grateful or not.
Right.
Go ahead, Karen.
No, I was going to say the slow-mo falling and like the slow shots.
Yes. Oh my God. It was so, I was expecting someone to just burst out, "This is Sparta." Like it was so intense.
So the two other things to note about this is that there were 8 million warnings about how kids should not watch this.
Yeah.
and yes, Sofer's watching it and we know he's seen worse, but it was very, you know, it was very much like they are very, you know, they're going to go into the violence and no, they don't care, but you know, the warnings are also excessive.
The warnings were excessive. It set up such a weird dynamic because they've painted that very right-wing politics are on the out. But also the like, you know, people that it almost seemed briefly to me that they were making fun of like overly triggering content.
It did feel like a parody, but I do think that they're making commentary a little bit on a little bit about like the safe spaces, trigger warnings, content warnings, to the point where it's getting to the point where the government is stepping in to make sure those trigger warnings and content warnings are placed, to the point where it's almost censorship, mm-hmm. essentially. I think that's kind of what I think that's kind of what it's setting up a little bit, which I thought was interesting because I agree with you. It did feel like a parody. I was like, is this an SNL skit for a second? Like, it was just really intense.
It's like, it is going to be bad. But the other thing to note is that Looking Glass is watching it at home, eating his old school, like Tyson microwave, or not microwave, it's not even microwave, it's a TV dinner. With the metal top that you just never see nowadays, on his snack table, with his mask still on, watching the show.
Oh, he's the only one in his house, too.
Hmm?
Yeah. He's the only one in his house. He's not married or anything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And there's like no pictures or anything on the wall. It's weird.
Yeah, he's very Rorschach in that scene, like more so than he was in the first episode where he seemed to like take his mask off and be at home, let's say that there's a contrast to when Dan and Rorschach teamed up and he, you know, would take his mask off sometimes and they would, you know, and he was a person and then he became more and more intense as his life went on. I feel like there's a huge change in Looking Glass from how he behaved with Judd to how he's behaving by himself mm-hmm. in his place. So we'll see what that means. Where were we?
So now
it's awake.
Yeah.
Oh, wait. The bomb. I'm sorry. Yeah, we got the cavalry also making a suicide vest.
Oh, yeah.
While mm-hmm. they watch American Hero Story. And do we want to go over the story of Hooded Justice that, you know, from the Hollis Mason book?
I think we could touch on it briefly.
Yeah, we kind of have...
We have a lot to cover.
Yeah. We do have a lot to cover.
So, in brief, guys, Hood of Justice was the only character, the Minutemen, who never had his identity outed. It was never, everyone speculated that it was Ralph Mueller, but I believe Hollis Mason was the only person who said that it might not be Ralph Mueller. But he was also accused of being a homosexual.
Communist, but he was really a Nazi.
He was a communist, and he was accused of being a homosexual. Everybody,
I think that was Captain Metropolis. Are you sure? I thought he was going out with.
He was.
No, it was. Yeah, Hood of Justice was. Yeah, because when he stopped the comedian from raping Sally Jupiter, he basically was alluded to that he was into being wrapped up by men. Like he was
The wake.
This was brilliant. She was so brilliant in this. It was very.
She's such a detective. Oh, she's so good at what she does, man. I didn't even question until the second watch. I was like, oh damn, she did it on purpose.
Like you're sitting there like, wait a minute, no way did she just faint. But this was very much, she was playing, you could tell that she was playing this kind of like weak bakery owner, right? With the, you know, she comes in, what was it, flowers and she's just kind of like, wait, this is, she's not, this must be, this is her Bruce Wayne, right?
Yeah, I literally was just thinking, like, she's very Bruce Wayne Batman, where he's, like, playing a role that we rarely, like, from the audience, we see her more as Sister Knight, but, like, when we do see her playing the docile homemaker bakery, it's almost jarring. I'm like, it does feel like Carolyn's been yelling acting. Like it feels like she's literally acting. And that's how good Regina King is, guys, because I can feel it.
So she goes up to the room. So they do focus on the painting. Do we want to talk about the painting now before we go too much farther?
No, I want to talk about the suit. The KKK, the Klansman suit.
Take us home, Vanessa.
Oh, sorry. So she's got this cool. I'm sorry. This is such a. I'm all about this, like the sci-fi little bits and pieces of. She puts on these cool glasses that look like owl, like the owl eyes, right? Like they're like super techie, and she starts, you know, scanning through, and she sees this fake wall or whatever. Clicks behind it. She's like, whatever. Sees the before that, we see the refocus on the picture of. Jen and Chad again. So that's when I was like live tweeting Wendy's theory from the first, when we were talking about it in the first record of the first episode of the first season, or the first episode of the, whatever, you know, talk about when she said that, like, that maybe, you know, Jed's dad or granddad was like a part of the original Tulsa massacre. I was like, oh, maybe, whatever. I was like, damn it, she's right. And then literally the suit appeared. And I was like, no, not the suit, the sheets, the dirty, shitty sheets of a coward with a fucking badge on it. And so, you know, her face was just awful. And then, of course, we get to the painting.
Wait. So this was very much, like, so to take away from, like it was very upsetting because I was kind of like, what? Secret. Oh shit! Like, and I knew too, because that was my thing last week. It was like, oh, he's granddad.
Yeah,
probably that guy they focused on in the first scene. And I'm like, but then I'm like, oh, come on. And
that one hurt. It hurt, man.
It's like that thing where you're like with the Weinstein, right? Where you're like, no, this guy's a good guy, totally a good guy. I mean, come on, I love all his films. And then you find out something, you're like, oh, come on.
John Lasseter. I met John Lasseter. I shook his hand. He called me by name. The man was on the board of the Walt Disney Company. He was a sweet man. He asked me questions. He treated me like a human being. When I found out how much of a creep he was, I sobbed.
Yeah.
And that just goes to show you never trust anyone with power and authority.
I know. Ever. It's just, come on, just for once, turn out to be a good guy. But anyway, so
I knew he was being a good guy, but I didn't know that was that. Yeah,
it was Watchmen, right? So there's going to be, everybody's got something. But he, again, this was very much like Rorschach and the Comedian, where he goes into the house and he finds the comedian's suit. Obviously, very different reaction. But I kind of, so on one hand, although I loved the effect of the 3D goggles, I kind of missed Rorschach's just figuring out the closet was the wrong depth for the room.
But she's not Rorschach.
I know.
That's why I was like, I thought it was actually specific. I think it was, I thought it was a specific choice to have her use goggles that were very owl-like. So I'm just saying, me and Carolyn are on team Night Owl. So just saying, I think it was purposeful. I know Damon Lindelof, and I know that every little bit, everything that we're calling out is done on purpose. Every single bit, little thing is on purpose. So I don't, I think there's a reason why she discovered it that way.
And everybody's a little Rorschach in this. Like, there's a lot
absolutely.
Of that.
Yeah.
I mean, his whole thing is he's the specter of the feast, so to speak. He's the ghost that everybody's talking about. But now, since we were discussing, she steals the suit.
Mm-hmm.
Not steals. I mean, I don't think necessarily you can steal something like that. I think you should just take it and toss it. And
wait, did we talk about the painting? Because
I'm walking us into the painting, baby. We are now going to talk about the painting.
The painting. Okay, so the painting. Hold on. Let me pull up make sure I've got the right two here. Way too many. Oh yes, so the painting was Comanche feats of martial horsemanship. When you look at this, like, the faces are pretty not great, but what he's doing is he's they didn't have photographs, and he's trying to capture what is, you know, the culture of what they're, you know, dying out. But you know what, we're forcing out, you know, the Comanche peoples. And this painting belongs to the Smithsonian, and it was part of an exhibit in 1991 that was incredibly revolutionary for its time. 1991 does seem like a not very long time ago, right? And it was just after, they called the Cold War ended, which we now know that the Cold War has just been lying even colder and secretly biding its time. But... But, you know, the Berlin Wall fell and the Soviet Union broke apart. And so America was feeling very full of itself at the time. And this show came out. And the thought of the show was to kind of take what we now know about the history of the West and kind of relook at these, you know, Western, you know, manifest destiny, expansion west, glorification, really, images. And nowadays, this seems like it's a given, right? You're like, you're looking at these things and you're saying, well, this is a white man, and then the, you know, the Native Americans are being killed off by probably his friends, and here he is saying how fascinated he is with Native American culture of all the Native Americans are being slaughtered. But that's, you know, this was like one of the first to do this. So they brought in all these artwork, and then they put cards next to it that were kind of, you know, more historical takes on the picture than what you're used to, right? Mm-hmm. And it exploded, and there was just an uproar with how this was, you know, revisionist history and destroying the West and trying to take away from American pride. And you know, you hear this stuff nowadays too, but this was at the time, this was kind of a revolutionary and ground changing. And they tried to shut it down, and they tried to get the Smithsonian defunded for having these paintings. And really, it was, you know, it ended up that they were sold out. But yes, it's just crazy. So this painting, I think, you know, we could talk about why we think this painting was chosen if you want, about what is portrayed in the painting.
I have a quote from the creator of the painting, from George Catlin, who painted it in 1894, mm-hmm. I believe. So, martial feats of Comanche horsemanship. This is what the artist said about it. Amongst their feats of writing, there is one that has astonished me more than anything of the kind I have ever seen or expect to see in my life. A stratagem of war learned and practiced by every young man in the tribe, by which he is able to drop his body upon the side of his horse at the instant he is passing.
effectively screened from his enemy's weapons as he lays in a horizontal position behind the body of his horse, with his heel hanging over the horse's back, by which he has the power of throwing himself up again with his heel clinging over the and changing to the other side of the horse if necessary. In this wonderful condition, he will hang whilst his horse is at fullest speed, carrying with him his bow and his shield, and also his long lance of 14 feet in length, all or either of which he will wield upon his enemy as he passes, rising and throwing his arrows over the horse's back or with equal ease and equal success under the horse's neck. Question. Everybody remember what kind of animals they were behind cows, but still, first episode.
That was very similar, yeah.
They were behind cows. And if you consider the whole story of this that we have so far with these two episodes is that it's about people hiding their weapons until they can pass each other.
Yeah, at the very last minute.
Which
is also like pirates, right? You have to hold your cannon fire till you're in exactly the right position. But which we'll cut to the next scene in a second. But they do kind of focus in on the faces in this picture, which I thought I don't quite understand that.
I actually thought that they were focusing. So I thought I saw color like from the cake, like the Klansman sheets to the when they were focusing on the white of the horse, all the way on the white horse into the scene where Veidt's riding on his white horse. There's thread that started with the beginning of the episode of the first or beginning scene of the first episode where this flip of the man in the black is the good guy and the man in the white is the bad guy, where he's dragging, you know, like the Bass Reeves like scene, you know, that the little Will kid is watching. There's mm-hmm. this like it continues to this imagery of like a subversion of black and white, where throughout history white is always seen as the force of good and black is always seen as, you know, a force of evil. So I thought it was interesting just seeing like how that color scheme keeps riding through. Adrian Veidt, not that great of a guy on a white horse. Of course he is. Of course he's on a pale horse. Of course he is. Like, you know what I mean?
In this scene, did he go past the pirate flag?
Yeah.
Okay, so now we also have the pirates again. With the
wait, I believe, yes, I
it was either this episode or it was like they showed the trailer again, that part from the. I can't remember.
Because it was the scene where he was riding, but I can't remember if he had the flag. Because I do remember it because he stopped and ate like a tomato or something. Or
yeah.
Like,
okay, so are we going to go into the scene now? Because I will say this incredibly disappointed me, and I may be completely wrong, but I feel like if there's not more to this, this is a waste of my time and I'm incredibly disappointed, but we'll see. There's got to be more to it.
I'm suspicious.
The play?
Yeah.
Did you guys catch the horse's name?
What was the horse's name?
Bucephalus. Okay. Bucephalus. What is that from? It's driving me nuts.
It sounds like a demon or something though, but.
Well, it's not Bubastis, right? I think it's supposed to evoke Bubastis. Okay, hold on. I gotta.
It might evoke Bubastis, but so
wait, I got it. It's right here. Bucephalus was an ancient Greek. It was the horse of Alexander the Great. Of course, it was the horse of Alexander the Great.
Naturally.
I knew the horse was important.
Horsemanship.
But yeah, that's kind of a pretty one-to-one ratio. You know, if he thinks of himself as Ozymandias, you know, when he thinks of himself as Alexander the Great, is one of the people he equates himself to, so that makes sense. And
I will say that when he bites the tomato, I'm sure it's an experiment of some sort, but he bites it, he squeezes
tomato
it
on a tree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he's doing something like as he always does, but I do, something about him was weird. Like I do kind of see like I almost wonder if he's like, he is a clone as well or something.
Then he goes in and it's the second episode and the second anniversary. So you got to wonder, is this happening now or is this happened a while ago?
That's creepy. I don't like to think about that.
Like, well, what if this is like each time you see the country gentleman, it's been a year of his time, and like this was all happening 7 years ago?
I think he's reliving something. I think he's setting something up and he's trying to relive something. He's clearly stuck on something. And I made him a note. I noted it. And I was like, well, A, Adrian shows how much of a cold-hearted asshole he really is. He's like so isolated in his own little castle and he's just a fucking dick, unadulterated dick. And then, but like his obsession with Dr. Manhattan is literally so, it's reached to the point where the doc's last words to him is just, is haunting him to the point where he's doing weird shit. Like nothing ever ends. Like he's literally internalized that to the point where he's building things. And like, so I don't know if we're seeing things out of order. I think we're seeing him trying to reestablish and relive something that, or recreate something that we don't know yet.
This is what I said was my worst fear last episode, that it was literally going to be about him needing to create a Dr. Manhattan that can tell him he did the right thing. And it's just like, that is so disappointing. Like, I need him to be a criminal. I know we might have another criminal mastermind and that's great. But I kind of, if this is really all it is, it's only episode 2. If this is really all it is to it is that he is just living out fantasies by killing clones and trying to recreate something, but he's not actually trying to. He could recreate the Dr. Manhattan experiment. I mean, he could totally. That is totally within his means, even in exile. But he's not.
Yeah. Why? I don't think he's. That's what. I don't think that's why. I don't think that's the direction they're going in. Like,
so if he's just crazy, what's the point of having him on the show?
That's why I think he's a clone.
I think he's. I think he's been doing. I think he's literally been doing. He's. I think he is responsible or helping, being responsible for these squid falls. I don't think he's staying out of the. I think he's staying out of the public eye for a specific reason. He's just doing all this weird shit because he's weird. But he's got a bigger purpose in the fact that he's literally continuing this like hoax of government squid falls every so often or whatever. I don't think that they can do that without him and his technology.
I have an answer. Okay. Can I do my acting stuff now? Okay. So there is a line in the right before they launch, because obviously we are leading up to the reenactment, the play in 5X. There is a line that Ozymandias gives to to the woman. And he says, when is a lie not a lie? And she says, when it's acting. And then the clone says, may I have the watch back so I can use it as a prop? And he looks at him and he says, you are the prop. So there is a very real correlation between the idea of not knowing your sense of self in relation to acting. And that has to do with the psychological elements of storytelling in and of itself and what we take from storytelling. So basically, a lot of people, this is actually really fascinating. I was doing research for something else, and I learned a lot about why human beings tell stories in particular. So in the 1940s, there was a study that was done at Harvard University where they showed people a little animation, and the animation was a bunch of triangles and a bunch of squares, and the triangles and the squares moved around the screen, and then they asked people to describe what happened on the screen. And what happened was something like over 40%, no, not even 40, like almost everybody in the room gave the triangles and the squares personalities. They said that mean old triangle or that, you know, saucy little square. And they gave them all personalities and they gave them all backstories. And they basically told a story about what happened to these triangles and these squares. And there were only like maybe 4 or 5 people in the room who were like, the triangles moved around and the triangles did this and the triangles did that. Human beings are naturally predicated on the idea that in order for us to understand the environment and the world around us, we have to describe it in a way that tells stories. Somehow in our creation, we evolved this idea that in order to understand reality, we have to have our own grasp on it. And that relates to Watchmen, and that relates to the line about acting in particular, because the whole point of Watchmen is that nobody knows who they are. And when he says, when is a lie not a lie, in its acting, it's a commentary on the whole process, because essentially everybody is acting because everybody has no idea who they are. And everybody in the story, and everybody arguably even who's watching the story, is trying to form an imprint on and trying to take control of the society and trying to understand it. And you're seeing this in the podcast too. We're talking to you about these things, and Wendy has a certain way of processing it, and Vanessa has a certain way of processing it, and Tony does, and I do as well. But we process these in ways because there's a psychological element of it. So when you learn how to act, you learn in three different branches, okay? You have the cognitive, which means that by making meta-analysis of the environment, you gain better verbal skills, and you gain, again, more control over your environment. Emotional skills, you develop empathy for other human beings, you develop a sense of empathy for the world around you, and social skills, you learn how to work within other groups of people. So why is Ozymandias doing is basically holding a play? Because he wants to understand the situation that happened with Manhattan, okay? And he brings it up in another one of those Greek references with the Gordian knot, and it's an important line because he has to remind the actress to say it again. So during the whole acting scene, essentially they're reenacting the piece from the Snyder movie where, you know, there's a beer and we're gonna have a cold beer and I remember the beer, and it's like, shut up about the beer already. And he goes into the thing and he has to get the watch because he wants to control time and he wants to put his own spin on things, which is the essence of storytelling and the essence of acting. So he goes into the box. And she's trying to unlock it. And Ozymandias corrects her and he says, it is as impenetrable as the Gordian knot itself. And that is not what she says in the original comic. Okay, that's not what she says in the comic. That's not what she says in the movie. That is 100% him. So what is the Gordian knot, you ask? There's a Greek city with a name I can't pronounce. It's a Greek group of people. It's called the Phrygians. And there's an oracle. And the oracle decrees that the next man to enter the city of the Phrygians driving an ox cart will become their king. A peasant farmer named Gordas drives into town in an ox cart and is immediately declared king. Out of gratitude, Gordas' son Midas dedicated the ox cart to the Phrygian god Sebastos, whom the Greeks identified with Zeus, and tied it to a post in an intricate knot of cornel bark, cornus mas. The knot was later described by Roman historian Quintus Curtius Rufus as comprising of several knots so tightly entangled that it was impossible to see how they were fastened. Mm-hmm. The ox cart still stood in the palace of the former kings of Phrygia at Gordium in the 4th century BC when Alexander arrived, at which point Phrygia had been reduced to a satrapy or province of the Persian Empire. The oracle had declared that any man who could unravel the elaborate knots was destined to become the ruler of all Asia. Alexander wanted to unite the knot, but struggled to do so without success. He then reasoned that it would make no difference how the knot was loosed, so he drew his sword and sliced it in half with a single stroke.
Bingo. And think about what we did last week with the eggs.
Yep. So everything about the play is Ozymandias trying to understand how to unravel the knot, because human beings process information through acting and storytelling. So he is processing information through acting and storytelling. And it's more than just training. It has to have a personal connection because he is still trying to leave his imprint on the world around him.
I think I have to believe there is more to it than the surface level. But the one thing I want to point out that maybe it's a mistake, I don't know, but how does Ozymandias know how important the beer is? He didn't read the comic book.
Yeah, I was wondering that the whole time. I was like, how does he maybe even Janie know any of the details of the story? But like, yeah, Janie would have told him.
But she can't know that the beer is that important.
But if it's their last like good memory together or something,
I was gonna say, if he confided in her, she would have. Yeah,
maybe. It's possible. It is a bit of a plot hole. I'm trying to no prize it.
I can't. All right, so let's just take a moment to appreciate the fact that episode 2, we've already gotten our blue penis.
Before we got boobs, kudos.
but it was, it cannot be that simple, that he's just killing clones for his own personal psychological issues and that he's been spending 7 years.
It's not. You know that. I don't think you believe that either. I don't think you believe that either. You literally, you've unpeeled everything else. You can't believe that that's the only thing. Like, that's not, I don't think, there's just so much other stuff that, like, is going on that we've just scratched the surface on. I don't think that that's, I don't, that's like the least of my worries.
Yeah, they might bungle it, but they haven't bungled it yet.
No, yeah, we're, I don't think, yeah, I think once we get to the Lori Blake, I think once we get Lori in and like start to connect the actual, like the other pieces, I might start to worry a little bit in that point, but I think right now there's still world building.
I mean, remember he did burn Bubastis in an attempt to get Manhattan, which he must have known wouldn't work, but just like, so he will kill his clones, but I did think it was,
but that just seemed like
Bubastis. Yeah,
that, but it almost seemed like, just in the way he killed this clone, it almost seemed like, okay, that one failed at the cake or like something like that, or he felt too much when he made the watch or something.
It was too cruel. Yeah, it was like cruelty.
So I have to get rid of this clone and try a different one or something. So,
oh my gosh, he is, and he says, I wish you would have, what was the line? It's like, I wish you would have an original thought, or I wish you would put more things together.
Oh, yeah, something like, I wish more things would occur to you. Or yes, there's a lot of things I wish would occur to you, yeah.
Because I think that's, is that what he's looking for? Is he looking for someone to, the clone, to actually be as genius as Manhattan?
Possibly. Or as him? I mean, it's, he's, I don't know, I think he's obsessed with Manhattan for a different reason, but I do think that he's looking for something in his clones that they're not displaying yet.
Are they clones of him? Is that what you're saying? They're clones of
maybe his Adrian? Babies. Maybe he's got, maybe he's got, I mean, yeah, they could, I mean, they could be little mini hymns.
Interesting. all right. So we have no idea what's going on there. We know that tomatoes are growing on trees and that they taste okay, but then he tastes them to see if they're right. And then he waits. So that's metaphorical, right? He tastes the tomato to see if it's right. He kind of likes it, but then he squeezes all the juice out into the ground. Which is kind of what he's doing with clones.
See, I thought they were apples initially.
No, they're tomatoes.
That was the point, though, that you were supposed to think they were apples until you saw they were tomatoes.
You're supposed to think they were apples, so it's the difference between apples and tomatoes. So this guy's not, his attempts to create a second Dr. Manhattan are not the apple, which...
We don't know that's what he's doing, y'all.
Yeah, we don't. Nope. It's Adrian, you kept trying to figure it out, and
we don't
no
know
idea.
If he's doing, we don't know what he's doing. But we only have, okay, so we have, what do we, well, how much do we have left on the episode? Do we have,
I think it's, there's two more big scenes, or okay. No, it's actually just the last one with the older guy again.
Okay.
Oh, clocks.
Because, yeah, if we wanted to talk about Pediopedia, we're not going to, I don't know if we're going to have time for that.
Oh.
All right, maybe we have to do a second thing. We did talk a bit about it here. If you guys haven't read it yet, we'll post the links up. There's a site where they're posting supplemental material, and we did kind of pepper it in, but I think we've got 10 minutes left. But there are clocks, and they have different times on them, and this was an egg timer. It's an old egg timer that starts off the next season. Mm-hmm. We end with the pocket watch. We begin with the egg timer.
He gets out of his cuffs somehow. Slippery guy. Another enhanced evidence for an enhanced individual.
I think you're right at this point.
Well, yeah, and you could
hard to explain otherwise.
I'm just gonna keep saying it until they confirm it, okay? So yeah, she's just like perplexed as per usual. She gets the phone call that reveals, ba-dum-tsh, he's her grandpa. And so we learn in this episode just a little bit about her parents. Something happened to them. Not so good, because she kind of compared what happened to her parents to what happened to Topher's parents. So we're probably going to learn that soon. And he mentions, you know, your parents never talked to you about me. So there's some history there, some family drama that I'm very excited to get into, hopefully later on when they reel it. And then he already, and that's the thing, like, how did he know that's the phone call she got? She didn't even say anything. Did she? No, she didn't even say.
He probably got, like, he probably knew. Well, he knew she was going to test the DNA, but I'm guessing he, same way he knew he was going to get rescued by the people, like,
yeah,
probably communicating with him. Or...
True, yeah.
Something's going on. He has an egg timer, you know?
Something's going on with this dude. Yeah, there's just, and then we have, do we have anything, do they talk anymore after that?
On the phone, they mentioned like another dependent of him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Which, does she have a sibling?
I don't remember any mention of
two ancestors, but... two descendants, which was interesting.
So he has two descendants. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like, yeah, I'm assuming he is. I don't know. Yeah.
Unless like his child is just alive somewhere and when like it's
if we're continuing the black and white themes, will she be the good guy and he'll be the bad guy, or will he be the bad guy and she'll be the good guy?
It's Watchmen.
No, if there's another dependent out there.
No, I think that's her dad. I think that's her dad. Okay. Another, not dependent, a descendant. Yeah, so it's, I think he's, if he had two descendants, he had a kid and that kid had a kid. And if he had two ancestors, they might have his parents on file.
Okay.
I don't know, I guess I would wonder if a dead relative would show up on that. But I guess that makes sense.
He's not the only descendant too, right? Like the baby too also survived. We have to assume. So well, she's got possible descendants lateral. As well.
That's his cousin. That's his cousin, not.
We don't know that. What?
His descendant. Like his descendant is his offshoot. It only goes the baby? Up and down. Yeah, they're not going to tell you you have a cousin. It was two descendants, two ancestors. So, baby would be a lateral.
No, I'm saying like Angela is not the only descendant. Like he is not the only survivor. So he's not the only one with descendants. There is also the baby that has descendants as well. Yeah, but why I wasn't saying they were related.
So Angela tested the DNA. Was it just to get the name?
Because I think that's all
she gets. She already knew the name
or something. Because when they asked her to say a name to verify that they were a descendant. So I think at that point she had an idea that she was either related to him or something was going on.
Because she didn't get too much from that. She didn't get like criminal records or anything from that DNA test. She just got that she was related to him, which maybe she suspected. But she got that he was connected to the Oklahoma, living in the Tulsa massacre. And she got that his name was his name, I guess. But she had to give the name, so I don't know if they looked that up. It's kind of unclear to me as to why she tested the DNA in that manner. But yeah, unless she kind of suspected it.
I'm sure that the system that checks the DNA would verify the name. Otherwise, how would it know specifically to go after her? I mean, maybe everyone's DNA is in the system, but I don't know. It's something, I feel like that's not a confusing thing.
But yes, so she decides to take him back. So now she's finally decided it's time to take him to the precinct and let him know. Now she knows that they're related. She's going to take him and they'll talk to him there. She'll let Glass interrogate him, or I don't know what she's thinking, but she doesn't want to hide anymore.
Yes.
And?
That's fine.
Giant thing in the sky takes him away in her car.
Car. That was really rude.
Like takes her car. She has another car, but that's her like secret identity car. So the fuck.
She did say to him, I could take you in. He's like, oh, she did just be rescued.
Yeah, like he has friends in high places. Yeah. And I wonder who his friends are. Him? Yeah.
I wonder if they'll like drop her car off at, like overnight or something.
Did you notice the parallel of the note falling from the sky to the beginning of the episode? Like, and she was just like, what the fuck is, like, literally, like, I don't understand. But I thought that was an interesting, like, callback to the beginning of the episode, which they seem to be doing a lot anyway.
Yeah, and I think, though, that this is when he gave her that note because it was important. She looked at it already, but he left that note because it was important, and I don't know what's the important part of it, but it's all connected. Of course, that's, you know, it's that's the crystal from Krypton, and and she's Kryptonian, right? So,
mm-hmm.
So maybe that should mean some more to her. maybe just knowing that, you know, here are the Germans using this propaganda against you, you know, to control you, like we, like Vanessa was talking about earlier in the episode, earlier in the podcast.
Yeah. I thought that was interesting, like how, you know, police in our reality are different in this than in this reality. And I wonder how, what A, triggered the White Knight, and B, how policing tactics are still as brutal as they are here. So I really wonder who, you know, the police aren't as set up as good guys as they could be. It mirrors the essentially, like, are you actually fighting for the good guys? They treat people like shit too, like, essentially. So I thought that was interesting.
Always fascinating. Well, so that's what do we want to talk about? Anything from the trailer?
Lori Blake is coming.
Finally.
So excited.
But she's very different. She's very comedian in this one.
I guess we can mention it since we're not going to talk about it in detail, but the PDpedia thing did mention that she went by the comedian, like a female.
Yes, the comedian. Mm-hmm.
So,
and Dan Dreiberg is in federal custody, y'all. He is not in fact good.
This is the question that, of course, you know, I've been talking about with my husband, and I think he's on everybody's mind, is why is Dan in jail and she's not? And I think it's because of Rorschach's journal.
I think she flipped on him.
You think she was just like, whatever. Maybe she's gone full comedian, but I don't know what he did, but he must have done something. But I think, you know, well, the other thing too is he is mentioned heavily in Rorschach's journal, and once that got published, he's then implicated.
Mm-hmm.
And a liability, and he does know. But it will be interesting to find out why Dan is in custody.
Yeah.
Is he in custody because he wants to, because he did something wrong, or is he in custody because,
it does mention that they were arrested for
in the 90s, yeah.
But I don't know if that's the reason.
I fully believe she flipped on him. Like, they got caught together and she flipped on him, and then she got immunity and she became a detective. Or maybe she was always in law enforcement. She, like, got in early and then spying on him. Like, I don't know.
Gave her a little, let her get out of there.
I'm still going with they knew he was Rorschach's partner, and then Rorschach had become this cult figure. He might be in witness protection, who knows. But he is heavily in the journal because they used to be partners. And of course, he is implicated as knowing about the conspiracy. So I would assume that all of the cavalry would want to get their hands on him so that he could validate, you know, what they're saying is true. Yeah. So he may be.
Yeah. Dan and Lori are the only people and Adrian, there's like, what, four people alive that know the conspiracy,
four,
right?
Four people. And Ozzy and Dr. Manhattan is gone. Who knows where?
So three people on Earth left.
Yeah.
That know,
and,
right?
Yeah. And they
assuming
all think
that's
that
Vite.
Yeah. Assuming that
yeah,
is
Yeah. Assuming
Vite.
That is Vite. Yeah. So yeah, that's what I'm looking forward to the most is Lori.
Yes. Okay. Tony, what are you looking forward to the most?
Well, also Lori, but Pirate Jenny, just to see if she actually does something. Like, I mean, she drove the plane thing, but that wasn't extensive.
Yes, indeedy. Okay, Wendy, what are you looking forward to the most?
Hold on, I'm looking at the title for Watchmen episode 3. Oh, is there a title yet? She was killed by space junk. So I'm gonna have to find out what that means. And we will talk about it next week. So I am looking forward to finding out what she was killed by space junk means. I'm loving these little supplemental materials. They may give too many hints, but there definitely is some stuff building up here. I mean, I feel like if we had like two more podcasts during the week, we could maybe get at some of these conspiracy theories, but it is moving so incredibly fast that it is even hard to just get in what we're getting in, obviously, in 2 hours. So, you know, you want to talk about, you know, deep history, you want to talk about how we feel about things with it, but just getting through the chunky bits in the episode and the PDpedia stuff is just so much.
Yeah, I wonder if we can just maybe just post like another blog covering it or something.
That might be a solid idea.
So that will do it for this episode. But if you would like to contact Watchmen Podcast, you can email us at watchmentvpodcast@gmail.com. You can post a comment on our website, watchmenpodcast.com. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail, you can call us at 918-200-9103. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram at Watchmen Podcast. On Twitter, you can follow us at Watchmen Talk. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Stitcher Radio. We always love it when you give us ratings and reviews. Watchmen Podcast is part of the DC TV Podcast Network. So if you are interested in other DC shows, you can check out Batwoman Podcast, Black Lightning Podcast, DC TV Classics, DC's Legends of Tomorrow Podcast, iZombie Radio, Krypton Podcast, Stargirl Podcast, Supergirl Radio, Swamp Thing Radio, and The Flash Podcast. You can subscribe to DC TV Podcast on Apple Podcasts and follow at DC TV Podcast on Twitter and like DC TV Podcast on Facebook. So until next time, tick tock, tick tock.